KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on Forum, with ongoing battles continuing to rage between Israel and Hezbollah, what should the role of the United States be? And what is the best interest of this nation, and how does that translate in terms of isolation versus intervention, action versus non-action? We'll also update you on what's going on with disarmament proposals. Forum is next with your calls and emails after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum. In this morning's opening hour of Forum, we're going to look at the stake the United States has in the present ongoing conflict in the Middle East and consider what course of action or inaction works best for American interests. Israel is indisputably one of this nation's closest and most favored allies, but the United States seems bound to work on behalf of balancing its relations with Arab states like Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and Jordan, and the rest of the Arab world, and the U.S. has, of course, its own ongoing war in Iraq. Are all terrorist organizations to be opposed by the United States with the same determination? Hezbollah, for example, has been held responsible for hundreds of American deaths in the infamous Marine Barracks bombing in Beirut back in 1983, and also was directly involved in the murder of American intelligence officers in Lebanon. The United States State Department has officially declared Hezbollah a terrorist organization. Yet it appears that Hezbollah, unlike al-Qaeda, focuses its concern almost exclusively on battling non-Arab occupying powers as opposed to waging a global war against the United States and the West like al-Qaeda. Similarly, Hamas, also listed by the United States as a terrorist organization and like Hezbollah, integrally involved in governing, appears to be concerned about almost exclusively with going against Israel and, like Hezbollah, seeking that nation's defeat. Leaders concerned about Hezbollah's leading sponsor, Iran, have been advocating the destruction of the state of Israel, that is, leaders of Hamas. So where should the United States stand in all this? Joining us for discussion this morning on the U.S. stake in the Middle East and what its course ought to be are, first off, Peter Tarnoff, who is president of the International Advisory Corporation. He was Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs in the Clinton administration from 93 to 97, and he joins us from Chester, Nova Scotia. Welcome, Peter Tarnoff.
Thank you, Michael.
Glad to have you. Also glad to have with us John Pfeffer this morning, who is co-director of Foreign Policy and Focus and directs the Global Affairs Program at the International Relations Center, also editor of Power Trip, U.S. Unilateralism and Global Strategy after September 11th. He joins us from Hyattsworth, Maryland, outside of the nation's capital. Welcome, John Pfeffer.
Thank you.
And joining us here in the studio this morning is Matt Kraning, and he is Herbert York Fellow with the Institute of Global Conflict and Cooperation at UC Berkeley, former Pentagon strategist, Undersecretary Rumsfeld. Welcome, Matt Kraning.
And good morning, Michael.
Good morning to you. Let's begin, Peter Tarnoff, with you. There are strategic and certainly economic interests that are undeniable in terms of the United States and the Middle East. But what about this whole distinction between, on the one hand, say, Hamas and Hezbollah not being global in terms of wanting to establish a Western caliphate, for example, and being seen as perhaps identical by the State Department to al-Qaeda?
Well, Michael, I think that the reason for taking seriously the possibility of having some sort of contact, not necessarily a direct contact with those organizations, has to do with the influence they have on the ground. They clearly, whether we like it or not, and we have good reasons for not liking it, have established themselves in the case of Hamas in Gaza and now with Hezbollah in Lebanon in conflict with the Israelis. So the question that we have is, what, if any, way does the United States have to have some sort of influence on that, their behavior, working very close with our friends and allies in the region, and especially Israel? I think that the only way we can at least approach that subject politically and diplomatically at this point is through Syria and Iran. And I realize that that presents all sorts of precedential problems for us and problems of other issues that have not been resolved between the United States and Syria on the one hand and the United States and Iran on the other hand. But if we are going to continue to play a role, which I think is absolutely indispensable in our interest and in the interest of our friends, especially Israel and the region, I think that there has to be some way for the United States to communicate to those organizations. And remember at the same time, Michael, that 15 or 20 years ago it was thought out of the question for the United States to be in touch with the Palestinian Liberation Organization, except for the fact that the situation evolved with the agreement of our Israeli friends, and things led to at least a initial contact and some measure of agreement between Israel and the PLO. So this evolution has taken place in the past, and I think it's got to occur in some form here again.
There is a good deal of concern, though, that the United States is being seen in the Arab world as more than an ally of Israel in the same way that Iran is being seen as more than an ally of Hezbollah. And just how much does that affect the relations between the United States and, on the one hand, its allies like Egypt, Jordan, and Saudi Arabia, but also just overall the Islamic Arab world?
Yes, that is a perception, but it's not totally inaccurate that the United States has had a long and extremely close relationship with Israel, and that will continue. On the other hand, it's because the United States has a unique relationship with Israel and a measure of influence on Israel that every time there has been progress, either in setting ceasefires or in diplomatic recognitions between Israel and the Arab states, Egypt and Jordan in particular, it's because the United States has had this relationship with Israel and has been able to work with Israel to advance our common interests in the region, which, of course, involve and has involved on many occasions ceasefires and a measure of diplomatic agreement. So I would turn the question around and say to those who are concerned about the relationship with Israel that it's because of the uniqueness of our ties with the state of Israel that the United States can work with the Israeli government to bring about, in this case, first a ceasefire and then possibly a measure of agreement with regard to disengagement and the dispatch of an international force, which, of course, is being talked about at the United Nations these days.
What are your hopes for example, this agreement that's been pretty much hammered out by the United States and France of disengagement?
I'm afraid it's not going to work because it does not address the question of the removal of Israeli forces from Lebanon. And unless there is a commitment by Israel to do it, or at least a notional timetable, I'm afraid that the Arab countries in general will feel that it's insufficient. So it's on the issue of when and how the Israeli forces will leave Lebanon, and of course what they will be replaced by, and there is a lot of discussion of an international force possibly led by France that is at this moment the sticking point.
Peter Tarnoff again with us this morning from Nova Scotia as president of the International Advisory Corporation and was Under Secretary of State for Political Affairs in the Clinton administration from 93 to 97. Matthew Krenig is Herbert York Fellow with the Institute of Global Conflict and Cooperation at UC Berkeley and former Pentagon strategist under Secretary Rumsfeld. Well, Matt Krenig, we went to war to protect Kuwait and Saudi Arabia back in 1991, and the United States has said it would go to war to protect Taiwan if necessary, and certainly recently President Bush was quoted as saying, you bet, if asked would he protect Israel against Iran. This sounds to many people like the United States is just too hegemonic, too spread out all over, protecting too many things and too many other nations.
Well, right. I mean, I think, you know, the United States is a large power. Like all large powers, it has global interests. And, I mean, that's kind of a fact of international politics, and it always will be. But I think when you think about the Middle East, you know, this is the most vital strategic region for the United States and probably will be for decades to come. And, of course, you know, you have the kind of obvious strategic interest there. You have concerns with oil supplies. You have international terrorism. There's the concern with nuclear proliferation in Iran and also the fear that proliferation in Iran could set off kind of second-tier proliferation in Egypt and Saudi Arabia. But I think probably, you know, the most important reason maybe why the Middle East is important is one reason that's not often mentioned, and that is that over the coming decades, the United States is almost certainly going to be involved in kind of a Cold War-type struggle with China. And the key strategic region in which that will play out is the Middle East. The Chinese are already moving into the Middle East in big ways, trying to secure their own energy supplies. They recently signed a $100 billion gas deal with Iran. And so the United States, I think, will be involved in the Middle East for decades just to contain the Chinese influence. And, of course, you know, containing Soviet influence is the reason why the United States got involved in the Middle East in the first place.
China now the second biggest importer in the world. In fact, we're going to talk about China as a global power and economically as well as militarily in the hour up ahead. But Iran is also moving toward the nuclear phase, and as much as the United States is trying to stop it, it seems like they're on that trajectory. And they have said, certainly the leader, the prime minister of Iran, has said he wants to destroy Israel. Now, you get into that kind of delicate sense of how much should the United States, it's going to protect Saudi Arabia and Kuwait, as I said, from Iraq and protect Taiwan from China. Should it protect Israel from Iran?
Right. I think the Iranian issue is a big concern for the United States. And I think that, part of the concern there is that after the United States appeared to get bogged down in Iraq, the Iranians became kind of emboldened in their nuclear program. And they felt that the United States didn't have a sufficient reserve military capability to deter Iran from aggression. So I think going forward, the United States needs to maintain an adequate military presence in the region to do all the stuff that it's doing now, to stabilize ungoverned regions like Iraq, to be able to launch kind of rapid response counterterrorism strikes as opportunities arise, but also to retain a sufficient reserve capability to kind of deter further aggression from Iran or other potential threatening states in the region.
Are Hamas and Hezbollah, which are very involved in government now, Hamas and the Palestinian government and governing, as well as Hezbollah in Lebanon with a couple of cabinet ministers and part of the parliament, are they to be seen as the same as al-Qaeda, which really wants to destroy the West, apparently, as opposed to those two nations, those two terrorist groups, which want to destroy Israel?
It's an interesting question. You know, the question is always raised, is the United States really engaged in a war on terrorism, as it claims, or is this really just a war against a specific terrorist organization, al-Qaeda? And, you know, you can make an argument that the United States' efforts should be focused on al-Qaeda because they are the ones that really threaten the United States directly. But if you look at the literature coming out of the United States government, in particular the National Security Strategy of 2006 that was recently released, the government is clearly interested in really fighting a war on terrorism. It's really a war on the tactic. If you look at some of the language in the document, it says that the United States envisions a world in which terrorism is seen as just as illegitimate as piracy or slavery. And so, you know, you can argue about the merits, but I think right now the goal really is a fight against all terrorist organizations. And so Hamas and Hezbollah are being lumped in with al-Qaeda.
Well, is Israeli Prime Minister Olmert correct then, in your judgment, when he says that Hamas and Hezbollah may be starting with Israel, but they're the canary in the coal mine? They're going to move outward the way eventually al-Qaeda is.
Right. I think, the United States really sees this situation in Lebanon as a golden opportunity to kind of let Israel do some of the United States work for us, to really cripple one of the key terrorist organizations in the region. And I think also to send a broader message in the region that when push comes to shove, the United States isn't going to be very sympathetic toward terrorist organizations or toward the states that harbor them, either actively or passively.
Matthew Krenig, again, is Herbert York Fellow at the Institute of Global Conflict and Cooperation, UC Berkeley, and former Pentagon strategist under Secretary Rumsfeld. And John Pfeffer is with us from outside of Washington. He co-directs Foreign Policy in Focus and is director of Global Affairs Program at the International Relations Center. Again, he's also the editor of Power Trip, U.S. Unilateralism and Global Strategy After September 11th. Well, John Pfeffer, the old idealism was no damage, no harm, but maybe that's changed after September 11th?
Well, certainly the calculus has changed after September 11th, but it's very difficult to look at the Middle East situation and figure out a strategy that does no harm. And I think the previous speakers made some very important points, but I'd like to follow up on this notion of the war on terrorism and the difference between Hezbollah and Hamas on the one hand and al-Qaeda on the other. We, as the United States, have made a mistake in the past in kind of lumping all of these groups together. Obviously, lumping together Saddam Hussein's government with al-Qaeda in our attempt to justify or rationalize the invasion. I think we are in danger of doing the same thing again. Al-Qaeda and Hezbollah have no particular love for one another. Al-Qaeda has no interest in, at the moment, it seems, no interest in engaging in that kind of evolutionary process that Peter Tarnoff was talking about, in which both Hamas and Hezbollah are becoming political entities. To a certain extent, that, I think, is what the Bush administration and Israel feared more than any terrorist action on their part. According to the State Department, Hezbollah hasn't engaged in any terrorist actions for quite some time. it was more their political influence and their influence on the ground that I think Israel found most disturbing, and the United States as well as the backing that Hezbollah has gotten from Iran and Syria. Those are the targets I think the Bush administration is really looking at, not just terrorism, but states that we disagree with.
Is there concern in that, for example, Hezbollah-run Lebanon could be, in effect, like a Taliban-run Afghanistan and be used as a place of terrorist training against the United States, too?
There's perhaps the fear of that. I think that would be, of course, a worst-case scenario. My thinking is rather that a Hezbollah participating in a Lebanese government would simply be not supporting U.S. initiatives in the region. You could look to the worst-case scenario of a Taliban, but really it's the real state state activities, normal state activities, that the Bush administration would be most concerned about. But I don't think that really is a realistic possibility, or at least prior to Israel's attack, it wasn't a realistic possibility. Unfortunately, Israel's attack has radicalized the situation on the ground. It's given Hezbollah a great deal more support than it had before.
Not only more support, but also, let's face it, a kind of victorious edge where the Arab world is concerned. I mean, there's a great deal of the kind of recitations of Hezbollah's strength and Hezbollah evoking feelings of patriotism and feelings like this is the one entity that can stand up to Israel and so forth. So the question is, has it perhaps in the long run hurt the Western notions of what ought to be our policy in the Middle East more than it has? I mean, in other words, what's our stake in this is really the question I wanted to frame here. And I'd like to ask you that, John Pfeffer. What is the United States' stake in this?
Well, from the Bush administration's point of view, the stake is remaking the Middle East. That has been the stake since it came into office. It saw 9/11 as this golden opportunity to remake the Middle East. Remake it not so much as a set of democratic countries. That's perhaps secondary interest to the Bush administration. More important, really, is to ensure that the countries are aligned with the U.S., and that applies perhaps most specifically to Syria, Iraq, and Iran. But the problem with that is that the Bush administration sees only military force as the primary tactic to remake the Middle East. It has an almost toxic disregard for diplomacy, and both in the Middle East and elsewhere in the world, of course. It had opportunities to negotiate with Syria, to negotiate with Iran, even to negotiate to a certain extent with non-state actors in the region to bring about positive change in the region, and in fact, change that would be beneficial for the United States for all the reasons that Matt Krenig pointed out. And yet, the administration has insisted on the fist rather than the negotiating table.
What about that, Matt Krenig? The intransigence of perhaps the Bush administration, as I think maybe John Pfeffer is implying here, not even talking to Syria or Iran when it could be talking and maybe moving forward on those fronts?
Yeah, I would agree with that point. And I think, you know, the U.S. strategy in the Middle East, kind of diplomatic maneuver, needs to carry forward on two fronts. And one of them is diplomatic. And if I had one critique of the Bush administration, I think that would be it, that, you know, retaining diplomatic channels with key players in the region, Iran, Syria, and even Hamas is important. It shouldn't be seen as kind of a reward bestowed for good behavior, as the Bush administration has kind of seen it. But I think that it's also important to keep in mind that those negotiations really need to take place in the shadow of American power. And I think that that, you know, is what's going to get movement on some of these key issues. If you take the Iranian nuclear issue, for example, I think that, you know, as I kind of alluded to before, that Iran now feels that the U.S. doesn't constitute a military threat. And I think that's given Iran some leeway to kind of stall on these negotiations and give them time to develop their nuclear program.
And Peter Tarnoff, we haven't even mentioned oil here. I mean, certainly the United States has great interest where oil is concerned, but I'm just wondering, there's a bigger question here, a larger question that looms in my mind, and that is whether or not the United States ought to move in a multilateral way, as it did, for example, back in the Persian Gulf War. Or when it comes to intervention, generally, intervention ought to be done sort of solely on its own, for its own concern or for humanitarian concerns like Bosnia and Rwanda suggested. I mean, these are the bigger questions, it seems to me.
Yes, they are bigger questions, and it's been something that has been swirling around the Bush administration since it took office 6 years ago, and that is whether or not there is a preference for unilateral action or multilateral action. But with regard to the situation we're dealing with now, I think the Bush administration is looking very much for friends and supporters in the United Nations, in the region and elsewhere, and is not attempting to do it alone. Interestingly enough, the framework for the Bush diplomatic activity in the Middle East, or at least in the Israeli-Palestinian dispute, has been the quartet, which involves the Europeans, the Russians, and the United Nations. So there's been no lack of multilateral action on the part of the Bush administration with regard to that specific problem. Ironically, in the past, if you go back to the foundation of the State of Israel in the late 40s and the various times the United States has been involved in breakthrough negotiations, it's been rather that the United States has taken a lead. It happened in 1973 when Henry Kissinger engaged in shuttle diplomacy. It happened when President Carter brought together Sadat and Begin. And, of course, it happened in 1993 when President Clinton brought to the White House Prime Minister Rabin and Chairman Arafat. So this is a part of the world where all of the players, including those most opposed to the United States, recognize that we have an indispensable role. And I'm afraid that right from the beginning, this administration has backed off the kind of unique leadership that has been so important to the small progress, but the real progress that has sometimes been achieved in the Middle East. How we do that now is a difficult task, but I do not think that by sending rather junior, very, very qualified, but rather junior officials to the region, which is now being done, is the way to proceed. Secretary Rice has been involved, but this may be a time for George Bush to step forward. This is a major issue. He has stayed away from the region in a direct way, and if he were to engage himself, I think it could have a dramatic and maybe tonic effect. It's not easy. The risk of failure is great, but there's no substitute for the President of the United States, and I would hope that the White House will finally, better late than never, look to the role of the President and the roles that U.S. presidents have played in the past and think of having the President personally become involved.
What about that, John Pfeffer, indispensable role of the United States, President involved directly?
Well, you know, ordinarily I give a kind of knee-jerk response to support multilateralism, but in this case, I actually think that there is a role for unilateral action here on the part of the United States, and I think, as Peter earlier said, the United States can have tremendous influence on Israel. We provide Israel with an enormous amount of military supplies, and we can exert influence in that direction. I think a little arm twisting to get Israel to agree to terms which perhaps it might not feel, at least at first, entirely comfortable with, but which will lead to some kind of resolution would be ideal. And I think if President Bush is willing to do that, so be it.
Well, we're coming up on a break here, and I'm going to invite our listeners to join us in this conversation talking about the U.S. stake in the Middle East and United States' role in the Middle East, what factors ought to guide engagement, and let us hear from you. If you have some thoughts and would like to contribute, or questions or comments, we welcome your calls, whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. You can join us now, toll-free, 866-733-6786. Again, our toll-free number for your calls is 866-733-6786, or join us by email. Email address here is forum@kqed.org, talking with Peter Tarnoff of the International Advisory Corporation, John Pfeffer of Foreign Policy and Focus, and Matthew Krenig of UC's Institute of Global Conflict and Cooperation. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about the U.S. stake in the Middle East and the role of the United States in the Middle East, talking with Matthew Krenig, who's here with us in studio, Herbert York Fellow at the Institute of Global Conflict and Cooperation at UC Berkeley, former Pentagon strategist with Secretary Rumsfeld, and John Pfeffer with us by phone from outside of Washington, who co-directs Foreign Policy and Focus and is director of the Global Affairs Program at the International Relations Center, also editor of Power Trip, U.S. Unilateralism and Global Strategy After September 11th. And Peter Tarnoff, who is president of the International Advisory Corporation and was Under Secretary of State for Political Affairs in the Clinton administration from 1993 to 1997 and is with us this morning from Chester, Nova Scotia. I'd like to get a read from you, if I could, John Pfeffer, before we go to our callers here. Would you agree with the analysis you heard from Peter Tarnoff that it would be unlikely that this proposal that's being put forth by the United States and France is apt to go forward unless there's some kind of agreement about Israeli troops and where they're going to be?
I would agree with that. I mean, the Lebanese government seems to be quite unhappy with this draft. It probably would have been a good idea to consult with some of the other forces on the ground in order to shape a better agreement. So I would say that in its current draft, it's unlikely to move forward. However, it might generate enough discussion and realignment to put forward another draft later on that will have more chance of success.
And Matthew Krenning, how do you see it?
Well, I'm reminded of a quote from St. Augustine, the famous Christian theologian, who said, God grant me chastity, but not just yet. And I think the United States and some of the other key actors on this are kind of saying the same thing. Give us peace, but not just yet. I think part of the art of diplomacy is to appear to be seeking an agreement even when you're not. And I think that there was really no expectation that this initial agreement would be agreed to by Lebanon and by Hezbollah. But the idea was to put it out there. If they agree to it, great. If not, it gives some time for things to develop on the ground that may put in position kind of a situation for a more stable peace in the future.
Is there, Peter Tarnoff, just generally, do you think, a kind of laissez-faire attitude by this government toward Israel? I mean, in terms of allowing Israel to do what it's doing without twisting any arms?
I think at the outset, the Bush administration 6 years ago was very hesitant to continue the activism that President Clinton had brought to the issue, probably because that they thought that there was no, in the long term, short prospect that things would get better, but also because this president wanted to address issues in a more systematic, deliberate way. And let's remember that just about the time George Bush took office in the United States, Ariel Sharon took office in Israel, and that indicated a move towards a harder line, less accommodating mood in Israel itself. So I think the two were together, at least for a period of time. But as I think all of us have been saying in different ways, unless and until the United States takes an active position and becomes the diplomatic and political leader, there is no reason to believe, in my view, that the situation will improve anytime soon. And that's why I feel that, while yes, it may make some tactical sense for the administration to put forth a resolution with France at the Security Council, if, and I agree, there is no chance of it happening, and this is only going to prolong the agony and deepen the hatred and the war and make a diplomatic solution even less likely in the short term, I think they should get on with more serious business. And part of that involves a more active role by the United States, which everyone would welcome. I don't think you would have people feeling the United States is acting unilaterally if we were to break out and come forward with our ideas. And as I mentioned earlier, I think this is a unique opportunity for the president to act as well.
Getting back, though, Peter, just for a moment before we hear from our listeners, to the central question of the stake the United States has in this conflict. What do you see as short and long-term national security issues for the United States that ought to indeed act as a beacon for its becoming more involved?
For all the reasons that we've all been saying, including the oil factor that you added on, Michael, a few moments ago, and that is that we're talking about a region in the world that is extremely important to us for resource reasons, for political reasons. We, after all, have 130,000 troops not too far from the scene of this fighting, so we have commitments on the ground, and unless there can be a movement, and maybe this is a process, maybe this is a Madrid conference-type form of the sort that the first Bush administration put together after the first Gulf War, the United States can see a situation not only out of control, but moving in directions that will compromise our interests, and I'm afraid bring pressure on the state of Israel, because as we've at least referred to a couple of times in this conversation, having a Hamas government in Gaza also adds a pressure point on Israel, and there does not seem to be any direct strategic focus on the part of the United States with regard to a resolution of at least some of these issues. And I'm afraid the situation may get even worse, more conflict, more killing, more criticism of the United States, more pressure on Israel before it gets better. And I don't, for the life of me, understand why it's taking so long.
Let's bring our callers on. John, you're first up here. Good morning.
Good morning. My question is regarding with Hamas. What would you say is the lever that, or the parties that could actually bring pressure to bear on Hamas to recognize Israel, to denounce terrorism, and to actually come to the bargaining table? I mean, clearly, I don't think it's the United States, but I think it's either Europeans or some other regional players. I was just curious what your panel thought about that, and I'll take my question, I guess, off the air.
All right, we thank you for the call. John Pfeffer.
Well, my initial response is that Israel would be the party that would have been most responsible if they had actually sat down with Hamas when it was elected. Then perhaps we wouldn't be in the situation we're in today. Of course, that is not at the moment an opportunity, but other countries are going to have to come up, step forward, and talk with Hamas and try to get Hamas to sit down now with Israel and other countries. And that, you know, at the moment we're looking at Qatar in the UN playing a pivotal role, representing kind of Arab voices. On the ground, we're going to look at regional actors such as Syria or Iran, perhaps, if we can push a more kind of diplomatic solution down the road.
And that's John Pfeffer, co-director of Foreign Policy and Focus and director of Global Affairs Program at the International Relations Center. Actually, follow-up from an email from a listener named Michael. John Pfeffer says, I'm shocked that I never see attention drawn toward the most glaring contradiction in American policy in this region. The U.S. claims it's supporting democracy and wants to see it take root, yet the U.S. has completely rejected the results of the Palestinian election as Israel jails and kills their elected officials and has supported Israel in attacking Lebanon, a democratic country. At the same time, our biggest allies are Saudi Arabia and Egypt, two completely undemocratic regimes. Sounds like we won't take yes for an answer.
That's absolutely correct. I mean, again, this goes back to my earlier comment that we have stated that democracy promotion is a chief goal for the United States government. But in fact, in practice, it's not at all what we're interested in. The fact that we are not happy with Hamas and the Lebanese government was because of their alignment, not about anything to do with democratic process. And either the U.S. government is going to have to become more accepting of democratic processes that produce results that are not what we expect, or we're going to have to change our explicit goals and actually stop being hypocritical about democracy promotion.
Here's a question, Peter Turner, from a listener who takes up that whole issue again of national interest and says, please get your guests to explain national interests. If England had all the oil, would the U.S. be invading England for national interests? I've yet to hear a journalist ask President Bush or any other public speaker about national interests. Why does everyone seem to believe this is the U.S. is an alienable right?
Well, I'm not sure I understand the point of the question, but I would answer surprisingly, we might well have very great security concerns if England had all the oil and was going to pass into the hands of forces that were hostile to the United States. I'm not saying that the oil factor was in the first Gulf War or is now a paramount issue. I don't think it was or is. But one of the obligations that our government has is to work on the world scene in ways that advance American economic interests, an appropriate task of any government, wherever it is. And therefore, I think keeping an eye on the sources of oil is something that's perfectly legitimate for the United States. How we do it, of course, is another matter. And that's where you can get differences of opinion on whether more diplomacy and less military intervention isn't, in the longer run, a smarter way for us to proceed.
And Matthew Craning, a question from a listener named Tomas who says, what supply route do these missiles take from Iran to Lebanon? Are they being transported by ship? Are they going through Iraq under the nose and complacency of the U.S. military through Turkey? Seems like that's the key to cut off the supply of arms from Iran to Lebanon.
Yeah, I think that is a key issue. And I think there, you know, really when the missiles came in was Israel withdrew in 2000. And so in that six-year period, it really gave Hezbollah a great opportunity to resupply from Iran and from Syria. And some of this military hardware is originally actually Russian-made military hardware. And
they're mostly coming in through Iran from Syria, aren't they?
Yeah, that's correct. And so I think that's really the trade-off that Israel is facing now, that while they were occupying Lebanon, of course, they suffered many costs, but then now they're facing the trade-off. Would they rather have the kind of cost of occupation or sit back and let Hezbollah rearm? And, you know, I think that, you know, the soldiers on the ground are saying that Hezbollah has night vision goggles, has very high-tech military equipment. And so I think the cost of kind of staying back are seen to outweigh the cost of being involved at this point.
Hezbollah was under a UN resolution to be disarmed, and at this point, obviously, that has not taken place. Clearly, it seems to me that they would not be willing to go along with that resolution, have not been willing, and won't be willing.
Right. Hezbollah will not be willing to go along with it. And, you know, there's actually been dissension among the Lebanese government itself as to whether or not they'd be willing to go along with it. But I think one of the keys to kind of disarming Hezbollah in the long term is going to be strengthening the Lebanese government and the Lebanese state. And so, you know, many argue that allowing Israel to kind of wage the war as it has is going to weaken the Lebanese state, and that's actually contrary to U.S. interests in the region. But I think the way—
Weaken an already weakened state?
Weaken an already weakened state. But I think the way the Bush administration is looking at it now is that building up the Lebanese state will be much easier with Hezbollah out of the way.
And we go to more of your calls. Chuck, welcome. You're on.
Thanks very much, and yeah, it'll be easy just like it's easy in Iraq and Afghanistan. Hopefully not quite that bad, but I don't know. But anyway, Mr. Kronick said something that I found very disturbing, that was that the administration is lumping together Hamas, Hezbollah, and al-Qaeda. And I guess given how all of the so-called diplomatic efforts have really seemed to be sort of a way to buy time for Israel to try and eliminate Hezbollah to whatever extent that's possible, and I don't think it is, that's very much consistent with that view, which is to say, if we look at Hamas and Hezbollah and, I guess by extension, Syria and Iran, and, pretty soon you're talking about the whole Middle East as a kind of an Islamo-fascist bloc, which is populated by, kind of lunatics who are beyond all reason and with which there's really no point in having any kind of engagement or discussion of grievances, then you really are left with a sort of a clash of civilizations model, which I think, well, that would probably suit Osama bin Laden fine, but I think it would be a grievous mistake because I think most of the folks over there are probably more or less normal people with some real grievances, but are not inclined to just throw in their lot with al-Qaeda.
Matthew Craney.
Right. I mean, there is this concern that U.S. support for Israel in fighting some of these local terrorist networks, Hamas and Hezbollah, will generate anti-American sentiment in the region that's actually contrary to U.S. interest.
Can it be any more anti-American than it already is?
Well, you know, I don't think so. But, you know, the other point I would raise is that I don't think anyone's really ever convincingly made the argument that anti-American sentiment is necessarily bad for U.S. security interests. I mean, if you think about, you know, the September 11th hijackers, for example, they definitely were anti-American. But as you point out, that's, no difference between them and the average person on the Arab street. But what is different about them is that they're willing to use violence to carry out their political goals. And so I think that that's really the set of beliefs that the United States needs to be countering in the region. That is kind of support for terrorism and the beliefs about the legitimacy and effectiveness of terrorism. And so you could kind of imagine a world in which, you know, everyone kind of hates the United States, but they hate terrorism a little bit more. And that necessarily wouldn't be so bad for U.S. interests. I mean, we know what dealing with that's like. That's called France, and it's a thorn in our side, but it's manageable.
Well, it's our close friend now again. Let me thank Chuck for his call and go to more of your calls. Riv, thanks for waiting. You're on the air with us. Good morning. Riv, not there? Okay. Lost that caller. We'll go to another one. William, good morning.
Yes, thank you very much. Michael, I particularly want to make this point because I know of your interest in the use of language. I think that I'm not sure we need a war on terror. I think we may need a war on the war on terror in the sense that the word terror has been defined. And by that, I just let me give you an example. If Hezbollah fires rockets and they kill civilians, then that is defined by many people as terror. If Israel then bombs a sewer plant or bombs roads so that medicines can't get to people and people die as a result of both of those actions, that somehow is not terror. I'm really concerned about the use of language and the way in which that sort of sets the boundaries of the playing field incorrectly. And I'd appreciate the comments, perhaps of yourself, but also of the guests.
Let me go to John Pfeffer on this. I don't think we've heard from you on this, John. I'd like to hear what you have to say.
Well, this has been a kind of longstanding debate among political scientists and whether one can actually have a category of state terrorism. In other words, states that engage in terrorism. In other words, states that target civilian populations in war. And we could look, of course, at the disproportionate response that Israel is engaged in today in Lebanon, in destruction of civilian infrastructure and killing civilians. But, of course, this goes back much earlier, and we could look at, you know, World War II and the destruction of Dresden, the targeting of Hiroshima, and so forth. I think it is important to raise these questions and to challenge the notion that terrorism is only conducted by non-state actors, that only non-state actors, for some reason, you know, hold civilian lives in low regard, and that states, for some reason, in warfare, only target soldiers, and it's fundamentally not true.
I wonder, though, the caller asked me my own opinion, and a good journalist I like to think I am, I'll keep it out of here, except to say that in the 60s we used to say, and I have a pedigree that goes back that far, that, you know, one person's terrorist is another's revolutionary and so forth, and I think you made a good distinction there, John Pfeffer, between state terrorism and non-state terrorism and the dichotomy that is set up between the two. But I'm also wondering about the fact that, for example, the Israelis have had a lot of collaborative damage and a lot of civilians have died, but they have dropped pamphlets and they've at least made some effort to warn people, whereas when Hezbollah fires rockets, there's no attempt to warn anybody, really, is there?
No, I mean, that's true. There's no question that what Hezbollah does is worthy of condemnation. The question really is the degree to which we equally condemn both sides and how we kind of judge the results. It's true, perhaps, that Israel takes some measures to prevent civilian injuries, but if you look at the results, fundamentally unsuccessful in many cases. The attack on the UN monitoring post, I think, is a particularly glaring example of a case in which the UN monitors put in at least 10 calls when they were under attack, saying, look, we're UN monitors, please stop. We're clearly delineated. It's very clear that we are UN. We are not Hezbollah. And Israel disregarded those calls and blew them up anyway. I mean, this is unconscionable.
There's still some debate, though, Peter Tarnov, as to whether or not Israel targeted that UN mission. Kofi Annan certainly accused them of doing that, but they've pretty stridently said no.
And I think they have to be believed, Michael. They have taken such a hit, including by the United States, for ignoring the warnings that I can't imagine that anyone responsible in the Israeli military, even at a local level, even as frustrated as they are, because a lot of the firing is taking place out of populated areas. I mean, the Hezbollah people have pre-positioned their rockets in ways so that it would be very difficult for the Israelis to pinpoint them, and therefore, it was almost inevitable that there be this collateral damage, but I don't believe for a moment that it was intentional.
Reminds me of when the United States hit the China mission in the Bosnia conflict. It's almost parallel in some ways.
Yes, intelligence is imperfect, and the Israelis probably had reason, not good enough reason, it turns out, to go after that target in that place, but the information was wrong, as what happened in Belgrade. You're absolutely right.
And we'll go to more calls here. Siddharth from Mountain View, good morning.
Good morning, Michael. I would like to just say a few words to put a perspective on the way that things are at the moment. Now, Israel is an ally of the United States. It's not United States itself. It's a country of its own right called Israel. And as a country, it has its own flag and system of government. In fact, it's so different that it sends a spy within the United States. That's how different it is. Now, what makes Israel uniquely related to the United States as an ally is the influence of lobbying within this country. The United States, therefore, should not get blinded by the ally relationship to hurt its own foreign policy. The United States must look pragmatically to its own interests as a country. Middle East is a vital area with which the United States must keep a harmonious tie. Time has come to keep things in proper perspective and to chastise Israel for its over-adventures. And that's going in the region. Israel must learn to live within with its neighbors and not be so arrogant because it's being provided with all the military assistance from the United States. I would like your guest to make a comment.
All right, let's go to Matt Kraning on this. Matt?
Well, sure. The question about whether or not the U.S. Alliance with Israel is just the result of domestic politics is an interesting one. Certainly, there's a domestic political aspect. But if you think about why the United States became an ally of Israel in the first place, you know, it really started in 1967 when France withdrew its support from Israel. And the United States was really concerned with two things. One, with keeping an outside great power, the Soviet Union, from intervening in the Middle East. And two, to prevent the rise of a non-Israeli hegemon in the region that could also threaten U.S. interests, including oil supplies in the region. And if you take a step back and ask if those issues are still present today, I think the answer is yes. I mean, the United States, especially with a weakened Iraq, is concerned with Iran vying for hegemony in the region. And then also, as I mentioned earlier, the rise of China and Chinese interest in the Middle East presents also the threat of an outside power trying to intervene in the Middle East and potentially threaten U.S. interests. So I think that, you know, there's no compelling reason to jettison Israel as an ally right now. And there are good strategic reasons for why we'd want to maintain that relationship.
Before I go to more calls here, a couple of emails expressing opinions. This is from a listener who says, I like the idea of the President of the United States taking a direct role in serious negotiations between the warring parties in the Middle East, but I fear George W. Bush is not up to the task. Alas, maybe it'd be better that he stay out of it. America has bad enough reputation worldwide as it is. Here's another opinion from Susan in Palo Alto who says, it seems to me that the only thing our policies have accomplished is to allow Iran and Shiite extremists to set the agenda in the region. Are they setting the agenda over there, Peter Tarnow?
I'm not sure they're setting the agenda, but unfortunately, even in this case that we're talking about right now, the role of Iran, the role of Hezbollah, is being reinforced. I think it is clear that if the Israelis wanted to think that they were turning Lebanese public opinion against Hezbollah, that objective has failed. I don't know what the Israelis could do at this point except find an accommodating way to disengage in some form on a timetable that is a meaningful one to at least begin to restore some credibility in the region as a government interested in a longer-term relationship with Lebanon that is not threatening to both sides. But as some Israeli cabinet ministers have said off the record, but very clearly, this month of military action has served to reinforce, not to weaken, Hezbollah in Lebanon and its reputation in the region.
John Pfeffer, want to weigh in here?
Well, I too don't really think that that the Shiites are setting the agenda per se in the region. I do think, however, that if the United States and the Bush administration in particular continues to downplay the importance of negotiations and of diplomacy, well, it creates a vacuum. If we're not there talking with people, if we're not engaged in multilateral negotiations and multilateral efforts, well, then, you know, there are going to be people who step into that vacuum. And so we abdicate a certain responsibility. And I'd like to emphasize that, you know, we have a responsibility in part because so much of the weaponry that is raining down on Lebanon today comes from the United States. That gives us a special responsibility.
Let me talk with you just for a moment, John, about the whole idea of multilateralism, because I happened to read an article over the weekend by former UN Secretary General Jean Kirkpatrick, and she said that the problem with multilateralism is it redistributes power like socialism. I mean, I guess you could expect that kind of language maybe from a former Reagan Republican. But she says, in other words, it's war or peace by committee, and it doesn't have the efficacy of unilateralism.
Well, that is an interesting perspective. I would challenge Jean Kirkpatrick to define what she means by efficacy if we look at Iraq today. I mean, that would be hard to say that that sets a high standard for efficacy exactly. If we look at another part of the world for a moment, North Korea, where, you know, we, in fact, have put forward multilateral effort, but we haven't taken it seriously, and we haven't really negotiated seriously with North Korea. Has it redistributed power in a socialist fashion? Well, ironically, the Bush administration has spent all of its time trying to pressure China, the topic of your next hour's conversation, pressure China to have influence over North Korea, when in fact, if we simply sat down with North Koreans in face-to-face meetings, we might in fact be able to resolve something. So it's.
I'm hearing you again talking about talking with the axis of evil.
Exactly. Well, you know, since the announcement of the axis of evil, we haven't, you know, established a very good track record through military responses. We've created a situation in Iraq that's worse, I think, than in some ways than it was before. The situation in Iran certainly hasn't worked itself out, and North Korea remains what it was before. And in all three cases, we failed to take advantage of diplomatic opportunities. I don't think it's too late. I think we still can.
Well, on that note, we're going to have to conclude because we've come to the end of the hour, but I want to extend thanks to you, John Pfeffer. Again, John Pfeffer is co-director of Foreign Policy in Focus and directs Global Affairs Program at the International Relations Center, also the editor of the book Power Trip, U.S. Unilateralism and Global Strategy After September 11th. Thanks also to Peter Tarnoff, who joined us this morning from up in Nova Scotia, president of the International Advisory Corporation and former Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs in the Clinton administration. And our thanks to Matthew Krenig here in studio, Herbert York Fellow with the Institute of Global Conflict and Cooperation at UC Berkeley and a former Pentagon strategist in 2005 under Secretary Rumsfeld. Thanks to our guests and our callers and emailers. Thanks to all of you for being with us this hour. We've got another hour of forum coming your way, and it is going to focus on China as a global power. I want to thank our producers, Robin Giannatasio-Mall, Hermione G., Kevin Guillory, and Laura Mall. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our executive producer, Raul Ramirez. And for all of us here at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.